Well, thank you, Mr. Henderson. Good afternoon to everyone. Hope you're all enjoying a lovely day today. It's been a little on the rainy side this past week. It certainly has turned into fall. I noticed I had the opportunity Tuesday. I was up in Cambridge, Ontario, Tuesday. We had an official meeting, Mr. Lord and myself. He is the chairman of the board of Cogwa Canada, and myself as the senior pastor. We met with our accountants. The church's finances were audited by the government last year. There was some concern about the fact that the bylaws were, well, they were what we would call boilerplate. When the beginnings of Cogwa in 2011, it was so standardized that it kicked out to the notice of the Canadian government. So they audited the return a year ago. We wanted to avoid that, so we actually had rewritten the bylaws, and this year increased our own audit from our accountants to a higher level. So that was an interesting day. We got a clean bill of health, so that was good. But I did notice on the trip that the leaves are even redder up there than they are here. So things are moving this direction. It will hit us, I'm sure, pretty soon. But if there was any doubt that summer had ended, I think it's probably gone by now. There are at least three reasons I can think of. One, the weather this past week. I tested the furnace to make sure it still works. You know, we've run the air conditioning so much, I thought maybe it drowned the furnace out or something. But apparently it still works. But I do think our air conditioning needs, personally, may be over for next year, which is a good thing in terms of the electricity bill. The fact that the calendar says October, which I'm still trying to figure out, is another hint. And the biggest of all, alluded to in the sermonette, the Feast of Trumpets is just 2 days away. Some years were finished already. 3 years ago, we were all probably back home by now because the feast ended. The last great day in 2013 was September 26th, and we were probably all back home at this time. God's days always seem to come the right time. Have you noticed that? You look around and the trees start to change, or maybe it's not really evident yet. It doesn't matter whether it's early on the Roman calendar we keep or late like this year. It always seems somehow to be the right time, which is encouraging. But you notice as we move toward the holy days, something happens in comparison, perhaps, to our friends and neighbors around us. I don't know about you, but I sense a kind of a withdrawing on my own part. I realize it's happening, it's on my part. You begin to focus so much on what's coming up with the holy days, it's like you find yourself not as in step with people around you that normally you get along with just fine. I'm not saying that we were in the middle of a war in our neighborhood or anything. That's not happening. We have very good neighbors. They look after our property for us when we go. In fact, when we come home, we try to hide for a few days in the house so that they'll keep cutting the grass and not notice that we're home. Works pretty well sometimes. Other times, not so good. But you just feel like things are not the same anymore. You've such a focus on the coming holy days that it makes you realize the differences. Because the world is focused on so many things, some of which may be at least of passing interest to us, but other things, you know, not so much. In that light, I hope you had the chance to tune in to the In Accord this week. Mr. Franks talked very specifically about some of the things, those things that so consume our society, and why it is really not our focus. He reflected especially on the political scene and noted the fall holy days coming up and how they show what the real answer is to the problems and concerns of human beings. He even used that familiar phrase, feast fever, if you caught it at one point. But as he so rightly pointed out, we must take care that we don't get so excited and so focused on the Feast of Tabernacles that we miss the deep meaning in the Feast of Trumpets and the Day of Atonement, which come first. As he said, without those two amazing festivals, there could be no Feast of Tabernacles in terms of the meaning. In other words, without Christ's return and the resurrection of the saints and the binding of Satan, the millennium could never occur. And it's important that we remember that. Certainly our current American political landscape ought to be revealing to us, those of us who have God's calling, just how empty and bereft of any real hope that avenue is. And yet, it seems like every time it comes around, people are deluded into thinking, well, this time there'll be somebody who's got the answers. No, there won't be. That's the way it works. So in our society, sometimes people notice that and they just want to stick their head in the sand and wish it was all over. Some of them turn to entertainment, maybe to somehow take their minds off the other mess. So every fall, it becomes big news in the entertainment industry to discuss what the new TV network offerings will be for the new season of television programming. How exciting! Not so much. All we can say in the vast majority of cases is, why would you waste your time and fill your mind with that stuff? And movie promoters, of course, begin fairly early the buzz of Oscar talk as the year winds down about this or that film that's hitting the big screen. And maybe once in a while there's something of interest. My wife and I did go to view a movie recently that we found interesting about they call it the Miracle on the Hudson, the plane that landed on the Hudson River about 8 years ago. That was certainly of interest, although any movie has its points you can't endorse, but it was interesting to remember that. Around us now, if you walked into a store recently, or sometimes certain even restaurants where they have shopping areas and displays, we see those ugly displays for that most puzzling and in some ways most disgusting of the world's holidays, Halloween. And there are people who are just enamored of it. They're just caught up in it. It's their favorite. There's one house in our neighborhood that typically decorates to the nines, as they say, for Halloween. And it's mostly the macabre and the gross and the violent and just foolish. I never could figure out the allure, personally, of ghost stories and horror movies and demon influence. I just couldn't figure that out. And that's certainly the direction these things have gone in recent years, the last couple of decades especially. I vaguely remember as a small child keeping the day. My family came into the church when I was 8 years old, so I have a few memories of it. But as I recall, I usually probably was a Disney character or some such thing when my family kept the day. It seems like it was more innocent in memory, perhaps. And then with hardly a passing nod to Thanksgiving, that will come and go, and about the only focus will be about 2 or 3 days of the week of Thanksgiving, because it's not such a big commercial deal. The world will begin to get all starry-eyed long before then, over the next big commercial holiday, Christmas. In fact, there are some places that already have their Christmas displays out. They had it out when it was still 90 degrees out. It's kind of a strange contrast. How did all of this happen? There was a point in time when human nature, human beings, and the human race got really off track. How did it happen? I think this is a good time, with Fall Holy Days just around the corner, literally, to ask ourselves some questions as we get ready to launch into our observance of those special times that God helps us see we need to keep. Such as, for starters, why are you and I doing this? Now, if you happen to perhaps go out for a bite to eat after trumpets, after the last service on trumpets, it'll be a Monday night. And if you walk into a restaurant dressed like you're likely to be dressed after services for trumpets, you may get some glances. It's not because maybe it is because they think you must be really wealthy if you're dressed like that coming into a restaurant that night. Maybe they'll send the bill from their table over to yours in hopes that you'll not notice and pick it up for them. But sometimes people will ask. Sometimes your server will say, "So what's the occasion?" And we've gotten to the point where we just say, "It's a holy day." Okay, and away they go. That takes care of it. Sometimes there's a little more discussion, but at any rate, people don't understand it. The professing Christian world doesn't keep these days. They don't know what they're all about. They'll be working and going to school on Monday just like it's a normal day. And it's not. It's one of God's special times. It'll be holy time from sunset Sunday night till sunset Monday night. They keep some of those other incomprehensible days that I already mentioned. What's the difference? Because if you ever get into a discussion with some of them, that might be the kind of thing they would bring up and say, well, you know, what difference does it make? You do it to worship and honor God, and I do it to worship and honor God, so we're good. We'll meet in heaven. Never mind. What about our friends and neighbors who are not in the church of God? What are they doing and why? I want you to think big picture now. Big picture. Skipping over that ugly thing coming up later this month, the one that I particularly can't stand. For now, I'm just going to mention the two biggest and most common holidays observed in the Christian world, of course, being Christmas and Easter. Proponents of these biggies, the big days, point to the concept that each one revolves around Jesus Christ. That's the thinking. Well, it focuses on Jesus. Christmas, of course, they claim, is his birthday, which it's not. And Easter, they claim, is the day on which he was resurrected, which it's not. 0 for 2 is a batting average of .000 if you're keeping track. Well, let's put aside just for the minute the fact that both of these statements are provably false. By that, we mean that it's rather easily provable from the Bible that Jesus Christ could not have been born anywhere near December 25th. Yes, the record of his birth is there, primarily in the book of Luke. But it's quite easily provable it couldn't have been that late in the year. And with a bit of research and study, it's also demonstrable that he was not resurrected on a Sunday, but had in fact already been raised the evening before, as the sun was setting, ending the weekly Sabbath during the days of unleavened bread that year, thus fulfilling the only sign that he gave that he was the Messiah. You know it, Matthew 12:40. 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. There is no way you can squeeze that in from a Good Friday crucifixion, supposedly, to an Easter Sunday morning resurrection. It doesn't matter how you squeeze it and how you fit it. Basically, you have one day and two nights. It just doesn't work. So, we would need to show from the Bible, which isn't that difficult, that he didn't die on Good Friday, which I've never been able to figure out why that was so good, but instead on a Wednesday, just as the sun was setting, ending that day by God's reckoning of sunset to sunset. He was put into the tomb. Joseph of Arimathea claimed his body. Arimathea claimed his body and hurried to get it into the tomb before sunset as the sun was setting. And as the sun was setting, 3 days and three nights later, he was resurrected miraculously by his Father. But we're just going to set that aside, remember. If you want more specific proofs of those things, I'd be happy to provide them for you. Or better yet, why don't you look it up on Life Open Truth website and research it yourself. There's plenty there. But let's just focus for a moment on the argument that these days are focused on worshiping Jesus. Now that sounds like a reasonable thing to do, doesn't it? Sounds like a good thing to do. I mean, how can you go wrong by doing whatever you do, just picking something out of the hat and say, I'm doing it to honor Jesus? Well, based on a brief description of the observances, even if somebody could prove, as you and I can, that the dates or the timing are actually wrong, sincere individuals, well-meaning individuals, can and do respond something like this, but I do it to honor him. I do it to honor Jesus Christ. That's the immediate response to having their human reasoning in the setting of the times proven wrong. And in their hearts and minds, they surely are sincere and they mean those words. And again, it sounds fine, doesn't it? Sounds very religious. But you know, not all that sounds religious and not all that is sincere is correct. It is possible, as we've heard many years ago, to be sincerely wrong. To be sincere, but to be wrong. Let's turn to John chapter 4 and look at a very relevant conversation, a very interesting one, that Jesus Christ had with somebody who in his day was surprising to his own disciples. They were kind of caught off guard when they came back and found him talking to this person. John chapter 4. It was the Samaritan woman at the well. Toward the end of the discussion, in verse 21, Jesus said to her, "Woman, believe me. The hour is coming when you will neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. But the hour is coming, and now is, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father is seeking such to worship him." And then a very famous verse, at least it should be to us, "God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and in truth." It isn't acceptable to God to worship him with all sincerity, with all good intentions, with all good meaning, if it's wrong. And to say, "Well, I do it to honor him," his response would be, "But I'm not honored by it. I'm not honored by it." And verse 24 makes us pause and think about where we're going, because that verse encapsulates where a good deal of the trouble is. You see, while it's certainly true that to state that Jesus Christ is central and crucial to the meaning of the days of worship for true Christians, I don't have any quarrel with that statement, and I don't think you would either. There's something subtle they're missing here. In their attempts to worship, what are they focusing on? Well, they would tell you, on Jesus. But in what condition, if I can put it like that? I mean, what is, not who is, but what is the Christ of Christmas? He's a newborn baby, isn't he? That's the picture of him in that celebration. Now, what does the baby, a newborn baby, have to tell people about the way of life they're supposed to be following? I mean, I realize that we have a couple of speakers in the audience here who sometimes talk about the brilliance of their young children. And I have no doubt of that. But I also don't think we're going to get a deep explanation of the truth of God yet from those same precocious children. The time will come when they'll understand it and could explain it. But it's not yet. The baby in the picture of Christmas doesn't have a whole lot to say about telling people about the way of life they're supposed to be following, does he? It doesn't really speak to the picture we see in most of the Gospels, most of which focus on his ministry, the last 3.5 years of his life, when he did things like driving the money changers out of the temple and calling the Pharisees whitened sepulchres, who spoke very candidly and very directly about what people were supposed to do in worshiping him. Babies can't do that. Babies don't tell us much of anything. Oh, they're cute and adorable, I'll give you that. Unless, of course, they spit up on you or fill their diapers just when you go to pick them up. In which time it's, "Here, Mom, you can have the kid back." What about Easter? Well, that's the other extreme. Isn't that supposed to be about his resurrection? But why is it that the most common visual clue to the holiday, even though they put on their billboards, "He is risen," what's the most common visual clue of Easter? Isn't it Christ hanging on the cross? At least that's the one that seems to come to mind the most. A dead Christ hanging on the cross. Now, it's a good thing he did die for us. His death reconciles us to the Father. But of course, we know we're saved by his life. And they talk about he is risen, but we never seem to hear too much about what he instructed them to do and how to live after he was risen. Or for that matter, before he died. That doesn't come out very much. And then there's the whole troubling thing of customs that are clearly borrowed from pagan Roman celebrations, like Santa Claus at Christmas, and in the spring, the bunny rabbits and colored eggs, both of which, rabbits and eggs, are well-documented pagan symbols of fertility. What's that got to do with a risen Jesus Christ? Not to mention the fact in the scriptures he didn't tell us either to remember the date of his birth or to celebrate his resurrection. He told us to remember and commemorate his death, didn't he? But there's something very different about the days you and I have been blessed to have revealed to us. Go back to Leviticus 23 and let's look at the very first place we see most of them mentioned in Scripture. And it's something Mr. Franks talked about in this week's In Accord. Leviticus 23. Verses 1 and 2. And the Eternal, or the Lord, spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, the feasts of the Lord," or the Eternal, the ever-living one, the YHWH, the Tetragrammaton, the word that was so holy the Israelites didn't even pronounce it. They lost the vowel points. The Jews in transmissions have lost the vowel points. They've got so holy they wouldn't say it. "The feasts of the Lord," or the feasts of the Eternal, "which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations, these are my feasts." A couple of really important points, and they were stressed by Mr. Franks. These are God's feasts. These are my feasts, he says. And they're simply described as the feasts of the Lord, or the feasts of the Eternal. And they're also called holy convocations. Now, what do those two things mean to you? That they are God's feasts and that they are holy convocations. Well, first of all, to whom do these days belong? That should be obvious. If they belong to God and he reveals them to us and tells us to be with him on those days, isn't that a gift and a rare privilege? For he says, these are my feasts, but I want to share them with you. I want you to be here and observe my special times with me. Your family, I want you here. That's a privilege. Then there's the other part, the holy convocation thing. What does that mean to us? Well, holy is from the Hebrew word gadesh, which means sacred or dedicated or sanctified or hallowed. We should ask some questions. Who can do that to anything or anyone? Who can make something or someone holy? In this case, it's a period of time. Think about that from time to time, brethren, just the whole concept of holy time. It's lost on this world, even those who profess to be Christian. They don't understand what you mean when you say the time is holy, because that's not the way they believe. They go and worship on a Sunday morning, but if you notice, most churches you go by, there are at least two services, and some of them even have one on Saturday night if Sunday morning's not convenient for you. And that's their worship service for the week. The idea being, you fit God in wherever it's convenient for you. That doesn't sound like treating something as holy, does it? Not to mention of the fact, the problem, that day isn't holy to begin with if God didn't make it so. He made a certain time period holy, weekly, and we know annually as well. 7 annual holy times as well. It's holy because in some way, his presence or his influence is there. That's what makes it that way. Convocation is from another Hebrew word, mikra, which means something called out or a public meeting. And it goes on to say the meeting refers to the act of meeting, the people who are there, even the place where they meet. Or it says it can also be described as a rehearsal. That's an interesting word. A rehearsal, an assembly, a calling. That's what convocation means. Put it all together, and what do you have? You have a gathering of those that God has called out to be together with Him, which makes it holy because His presence is in it, where those there are dedicated and set apart for a specific purpose, which includes, according to the one definition for convocation, it includes rehearsing something. When we come before God on these days, He says, by the definition of the word in Hebrew, that we are rehearsing something. That's an interesting concept. I don't know if you were ever in a school play or anything like that growing up. My experience wasn't great that way. In fact, the only time I can actually remember was late in the time before we came in the church, and I was Scrooge in a Christmas play. I don't know how that happened, but anyway, I guess they thought I fit the part. But when we come before God on His special times, we're rehearsing. And if He has called them out, then it's command. It is a commanded assembly. We sometimes use that phrase for holy convocation. And if it's a rehearsal of something, it ought to tell us something about the actual performance that we're rehearsing for, don't you think? You know, God's holy days and festivals, when you look closely, while Jesus Christ, it is certainly true, is central to the meaning of each one, they also focus on somebody else. Who do they focus on? Well, brethren, if you think about it, they also focus on us as God's family members. And when they do, we can see ourselves in there and see what He expects of us and understand what it means. He brings us out on the stage of life, I guess you'd say, to which He's drawn us, and He walks us through our parts. He said, now I want you over here, and I want you over here, and I want you in this spot, and we're going to rehearse what this is going to be like when it happens. This is where you're going to fit. And every year, we go through the steps. He prompts us when we forget what we're supposed to say. Just like in a stage production, you have someone who will do that to prompt the actors if they forget. He gives us our cues. He says, this is where you come in. See, this is how it works. Remember this. I mentioned earlier the concept of entertainment, you know, TVs and movies. But who's the greatest director of the greatest drama this planet has ever seen or ever will see? Isn't it God who is working out His purpose and His plan? Think about all the observances that you and I keep with that in mind. Passover, for example, is a memorial of the death of Jesus Christ. But think back. As you sit here in this hall or wherever you've kept the Passover, what are you meditating about and focusing on and thinking of? You're focusing and thinking about Jesus Christ's sacrifice, but doesn't it come to your mind that He did this for all of us? As we take that small piece of unleavened bread symbolizing His broken body, we're reminded of the fact that He did this for me too. I'm sharing in that by this symbolism of the unleavened bread. You take a small sip of the wine and you remember the reason He had to die and had to shed His blood. And it's a very sobering, very powerful evening. It's a celebration. It's an observance. It's a ceremony of a kind unlike anything else we do in God's church. And it's very powerful. It's powerful because we can see how it applies to us. We see where we fit. Jesus Christ did give His life in payment for our sins, but everyone sins. He wasn't the only actor in that drama. If nobody had ever sinned, would it have been necessary for him to die? That's the point. There were others for whom he died, including ourselves. And we remember as we sit there, we think in terms at least of recommitting to following him and living his way as he instructs us, as he and the Father instruct us for another year. To walk as he walked, that he's our example. We think of all those things as we keep the Passover, don't we? What about the days of unleavened bread? Well, that definitely gives us a focus on what our role in this grand drama is. Physically, we prepare for the festival by removing leaven, don't we? We're reminded that in that week, in those 7 days, it's a picture of sin. And that we should be unleavened, sinless, as he was. Removing it from our lives as it's encountered, living as he lived. We're very much focused on what he expects of us. We're reminded of it every day for 7 days. Pentecost takes us back to the history of God dealing with his New Testament church at its founding in the year AD 31. That's one of the early scenes, I guess you'd say, in the great drama that's God spinning out here. It reminds us of the gift of God's Spirit, a gift he gave to whom? Well, to the church, to you, to me, to us. And the purpose of using that power of God to change and to grow and to overcome as first fruits of his whole plan and his purpose. Pentecost tells us who we are. We are the first fruits of his plan. We look at it and we say, I see. I'm in there. I fit. Now we're coming up to the great fall holy day period. 4 holy days in a period of 22 days inclusive. Very quick order. The Feast of Trumpets shows the return of Christ, but what else? What else happens on the Feast of Trumpets? The resurrection of the saints. And those who are alive at the time, as 1 Corinthians 15 shows us and 1 Thessalonians 4, will be changed into spirit beings. It isn't only about Jesus Christ. He's not the only focus in the meaning of the day, is he? It shows us where we fit. We'll take our place with him as he returns to put down rebellion and reestablish the government of the kingdom of God on earth over human beings. And we, as we know, are to reign with him. What about atonement that's coming up October 12th, 11 days away? Mr. Franks mentioned in a court, we watched it last night, don't skip over the meaning of those 2 days. How could there be a world fulfilling the prophecies that we find in Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel and so many other places, the minor prophets, of the millennial reign of Christ? How could it even happen if Satan's influence were still here? We ought to be able to identify a great many parts of it as we look around us. Atonement reminds us of the need to see Satan's influence removed from affecting who? Does Satan have a bad effect on God and Jesus Christ? Do they struggle to fight against him? Not at all. The reason Satan needs to be removed and bound is so he won't affect people. So he won't influence human beings who will be on this earth. That's why he's to be bound. You and I, of course, have the opportunity to strive to be at one with God in our lives now in preparation for his kingdom. That's the beauty of the day. But somebody, if we're going back to that analogy of rehearsing in a drama, somebody has to be cut out of the script at this point. And that's Satan. He's going to be cut out of the script. What about the Feast of Tabernacles? Well, that's the wonderful foretaste of the millennial reign of Jesus Christ. Does he reign by himself? Who else is there? You are. And I am. We think of our part in administering God's perfect way of life in this world and how it will change conditions on the earth. We read in the prophecies about how things will be so different. There has to be a way in which that happens. My sermon at the feast this year in Victoria is actually on the very first holy day. And in some ways, it's hard to know where you start. But I want to talk on, the title is going to be Day One of the Millennium. Where will it begin? What will be needed? How will we have to reach out to the people who are coming to us to be taught and to be guided? It'll be a challenge. It'll be something to think about. We are included in the Feast of Tabernacles. We see ourselves in it. The eighth day, or the last great day, is perhaps the most unique observance of all. Why? Because the world has the mistaken impression that this is the only day of salvation. They think, most people think, if you don't accept Jesus now, whatever that means to them, you will be lost forever. You will burn forever in hell. Doesn't make sense. It's unique, our understanding, brethren, that this isn't the only day of salvation. In fact, it's not even the major day of salvation. The vast majority of human beings will not know now before Christ returns. Their time will come, the majority, in the second resurrection, what we sometimes call the great white throne judgment period, based on those verses in Revelation 21. And it also shows God hasn't forgotten anyone. There are loopholes in traditional Christianity's view of things. There are vast, gigantic holes that you could drive a truck through. What if someone never even hears the name of Jesus Christ? What if they aren't Christian? What if they're, you know, Hindu or Muslim or Confucius or just confused? Then what? God's way doesn't miss anyone. The second resurrection is going to be an amazing time. Give that some thought as you keep the feast winding down this year and enter the last great day. We don't know exactly how long their physical period of life will last. We've wondered about references in Isaiah 65, if it means they might have 100 years, but we don't really know for certain. That'll be up to God. And in that time, in a physical lifetime, for the first time, they'll learn God's ways and really understand them. Guess who's going to be teaching? You and I. We'll be there too. Haven't you thought of friends and family and relatives that you look forward to seeing in that time in the second resurrection? And not from the perspective of saying, I told you I was right. Because if we have that attitude, we might not be standing there. But from the perspective of saying, welcome to your opportunity to be in the family of God. Satan's gone. His influence is removed. You were blinded in your lifetime. You're going to have a chance to understand. What a rare privilege that's going to be. Do you see? We're partners with God in His whole grand design. He's patiently positioning us exactly where He wants us. Read 1 Corinthians 12 sometime about the body and the roles of the individual parts of the body. He's getting us ready. As I said, especially on these annual holy days, it's like He takes us by the hand and walks us out on this grand stage of this drama He's performing. And He says, here, I want you here. And this is what I want you to think about now. Here's your part. Here are your lines. Here is where you fit. Learn them. And if you forget, next year, we're going to walk through this again. I'm going to position you right in the same place on the stage, and you're going to learn those parts. Because I want you to be with me in this. He doesn't leave us in the dark about His purpose for us. The world attempts to focus on Jesus Christ, they think, in their celebrations, thinking, no doubt, that this would be a really good thing to do. And they miss completely what He tells them He expects of them. That's a tragedy, isn't it? It's ironic. It's a tragedy. It's amazing. It's an amazing testament to the deceptive powers of God's great enemy. Why does it happen? Well, it happens, if we can follow our analogy through again, because they're not paying attention to the director. They're not paying attention to the director. In a way, you could say they're thinking that they could write a better production. I could do this. I could write this production. Here's how it should work. Yeah, that'll work. That's what it should be. I don't mean to question anyone's sincerity or dedication to what they believe they understand. And many people who, without really knowing it, keep certain godly principles in their lives are blessed for that, because God's law is a living law. So when you practice, knowingly or unknowingly, godly principles and right principles from His Word, it has a good effect. It's just when it's mixed together with so many other things and so much deception, sometimes it's hard to extract and pull out where the good begins and ends and the bad comes in. But they don't have the big picture. God's commanded assemblies bring us together to learn the big picture, what He expects of us. It isn't just about Jesus. It's about us too, and where we fit in, and what God wants for us, and where He wants us to jump in and be a part of it, and what the overall big picture is. Where else can we learn about those times? Well, you take a look at in Exodus. Chapter 23, there's a reference. Interesting description here in Exodus 23, verses 14 to 17. Three times you'll keep a feast to me in the year. Times, as you know, probably can be translated seasons. That's the concept. You'll keep the Feast of Unleavened Bread. You'll eat bread 7 days, as I commanded you at the time appointed the month of Abib. In it you came out of Egypt. None shall appear before me empty. And the Feast of Harvest, or in Feast of First Fruits, it says, the first fruits of your labors which you've sown in the field, and the Feast of Ingathering, at the end of the year, when you've gathered in the fruit of your labors from the field. Three times in the year shall all your males appear before the Lord your God. Now it's interesting. It mentions three distinct seasons or times here, and it identifies them by the most prominent festival in each one. But how many times are we actually commanded to appear before God in this annual listing of days? Turn to Leviticus 23 for that. We already read verse 2 in Leviticus 23 that these are God's feasts and that they're holy convocations. The Passover is mentioned in verse 5, though it is not a holy day. It is an annual festival. And then verses 6 and 7, it says, on the 15th day of the same month is the Feast of Unleavened Bread to the Eternal. 7 days you must eat unleavened bread. On the first day you'll have a holy convocation. You'll do no occupational work, the margin has, customary work on it. And verse 8 says, the seventh day shall be a holy convocation. So that's the only festival that has two holy days in it. The Feast of Unleavened Bread has two holy days. First day and seventh day are both holy. Holy convocation. We're to come before God. A holy convocation is a commanded assembly. Then we move to the Feast of Pentecost, or as it was sometimes called, the Feast of First Fruits. That's described in the next few verses. You look at verse 21. It describes that also. A holy convocation. Then we have the Feast of Trumpets mentioned in verse 24. A holy convocation. The 10th day of the month, 7th month, verse 27, the Day of Atonement. A holy convocation. Then verses 35 and 36 mention the first day of the Feast of Tabernacles as a holy day, and then it says there is an eighth day, which is clearly a separate festival since the Feast of Tabernacles only has 7 days. And that's holy too. So if we're commanded to come before God on a holy convocation on seven specific times, then so much for the argument, as some have made, that we should only take up holy day offerings 3 times a year because it says 3 times a year you come before God. Well, it says 3 times or 3 seasons, but then here in Leviticus 23, it very specifically says each one of these 7 times is a holy convocation, a commanded assembly, and that we come before Him that way. Each of those holy convocations, 7 of them, fall into the 3 seasons of either spring or late spring or fall. Remember something else as we move to the New Testament to see these same observances kept by the early church. Remember, the early New Testament church was overwhelmingly Jewish in its composition at first. Remember that. These people had been exposed to the Old Testament scriptures and practices of their forefathers their entire lives. While they didn't understand how they were supposed to keep them and worship God, there was no confusion and no you know, anonymity or no ambiguity is the word I want, about when they were. They knew that God expected expected worship on those days. What we would expect to find in the New Testament is this. We would expect to find occasional references to show that they were still keeping the days, the same days they had known from their entire lives. And guess what? That's exactly what we find. In 1 Corinthians 5, you find a reference to the days of unleavened bread. In Luke chapter 22, verses 14 and 15, you find a reference to the Passover. In John chapter 7, throughout the chapter, you find references to the feast. Acts chapter 2, you find a reference to Pentecost. Acts 18, Acts 20, skipping through, you find references occasionally all the way through to the same set of annual observances and festivals, the same ones. That's what we would expect to find. That's no surprise. What they didn't know until God opened their minds and called them was the expanded meaning. And of course, the change in the symbolic observance of the Passover. No longer the lamb and the bitter herbs and so on, but now the New Testament Passover that Jesus Christ showed his disciples how it should be kept before his death. And we begin to find allusions to God's plan. We begin to find a working in of references to show us how things fit together. For example, in James chapter 1, we find these words in verses 17 and 18 of James 1. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above, and it comes down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow of turning. Of his own will, he brought us forth by the word of truth, that we might be a kind of first fruits of his creatures. Now put yourself in the early New Testament church. If you had a history and a background of keeping the annual festivals, and one of them was even called the Feast of the First Fruits, if you hear this word, what are you going to think? You're going to say, wait a minute, that's the third festival of the year. And James is saying God views us as a kind of first fruits of his creatures. And you begin to ask questions. You'd say, well, what do I have to do with the Feast of Pentecost? How do I fit into the meaning of the Feast of Pentecost? You would have understood the harvest seasons of the Holy Land. Early harvest, smaller. Large harvest, much greater. You look around you, a very few people, by contrast, understanding. And you begin to understand. You begin to see what the picture is where you fit. That's what God's holy days do. Peter, in his first letter, in 1 Peter 1, makes very clear what the connection is of the first festival, not a holy day, but the first festival, the observance of Passover. In 1 Peter 1, in verses 18, 19, and 20, he says, "You were not redeemed with corruptible things like silver or gold from your aimless conduct received by tradition from your fathers." Very interesting. Peter's writing primarily to Jewish brethren. He was not the apostle to the Gentiles. He was the apostle to the circumcision. He says, here's what you had. You had your aimless conduct. All these traditions you received didn't influence what you did and how you lived. You received by tradition from your fathers, but you've been redeemed with the precious blood of Christ as of a lamb without blemish and without spot. Now, if you'd gotten that letter from Peter, and you had a background of observing the Passover in the Old Testament style, what would you think when you heard something described, when you heard Jesus Christ described like a lamb without blemish and without spot? It would be pretty obvious, wouldn't it? He is the Passover lamb. I get it. He indeed was foreordained before the foundation of the world, but he was manifest in these last times for you. who through him believe in God, who raised him from the dead and gave him glory, so that your faith and your hope are in God. That's an interesting word we're going to revisit a bit more in a bit. It all fits together. It all makes sense. We're all familiar with some of the passing references that Paul has in his letters to the days of unleavened bread. He mentions them specifically in 1 Corinthians chapter 5. Keeping the feast. Because he makes it clear that this was something they were expected to still be doing. Therefore, keep the feast. 1 Corinthians 5, 6, 7, 8, and through there. You know, we fully expect, brethren, to keep on teaching the meaning and the importance of these days to the people who survive the prophetic troubles ahead and live on into the world tomorrow. Take a look at Zechariah 14, a very familiar section, but one we need to remind ourselves of and ask some questions at this time of year. The first part of Zechariah 14 speaks of the return of Christ and all the saints accompanying him. But as you come down to verse 16, following his return, after he begins to rule from Jerusalem, the new world capital, verse 16 says this, "It shall come to pass that everyone who is left of all the nations which came up against Jerusalem shall go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. And it shall be that whichever of the families of the earth do not come up to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, on them there will be no rain. And if the family of Egypt will not come up and enter in, they'll have no rain. They'll receive the plague with which the Eternal strikes the nations who don't come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. This shall be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all the nations that don't come up to keep the feast." It goes on to describe a bit more about what the millennial awareness of God's plan will be like. Now ask yourself another question. I've often said, read with curiosity. Read God's word and ask questions. If God instructed ancient Israel to keep these holy times, and the New Testament church clearly continued to, and they will be kept, and they will be taught in Christ's millennial reign to the point that if people don't keep them, there will actually be penalties for not keeping them, does it make any sense to claim that, well, but for now, we don't need to keep these times? How does that make sense? Israel was given the holy days. The New Testament church continued to keep them. They will be kept after Christ comes back to the point of penalties for non-observance. Doesn't it make sense that you and I should continue to keep them? Pretty clear. You know what else always strikes me as we move into the fall holy day season? It relates to the focus I talked about for the world's pagan-based celebrations, because that's, let's just be honest and call them what they are, versus God's commanded assemblies. When you don't know what God expects of you, what is your hope for the future? If you don't know what he expects of you, what is your hope for the future? I've never been able to really understand the stock answers that come. Have you ever been able to really understand what it would be like to be in the heaven they describe as the reward of the saved? I don't know about you, but I would think the harp is one of the hardest instruments to learn how to play ever. I mean, why couldn't it be the kazoo? Or a comb and wax paper? Or even a piano? A little hard to transport here on earth, but I figure up there it wouldn't be so tough. But a harp? That's hard. Those who are gifted at it have my total admiration. It's amazing. I know there are certain verses that talk about angels playing on harps. Well, that's good. We'll leave it with them. I don't know about that. But the whole thing of being in heaven, what is it that you do? Well, it's the beatific vision. Good. I always wanted to be a basset hound. You know, you just look adoringly into the face of the master. Is that all it is? I don't understand that. I don't know about you, but it makes sense to me if I have something concrete. If it says, this is what you do. Okay, I can deal with that. People have answers. They'll say things like, well, we rest in Jesus. What does that mean? Or Jesus is our Sabbath. Huh? What does that mean? Or you must find Jesus. Okay. What does that mean? And I don't know that I've ever been made aware of an answer that makes any sense. I've never been able to figure it out. Now, maybe it's me, but I just don't get it. The instructions God's Word actually have for us make sense to me, but only because He gives me the ability to see it, and the same is true for you. But if you keep the days God commands every year, and you rehearse what they mean every year, and you get the picture coming clearer and clearer and clearer, don't you? And then what happens? Well, you can see, and it gives you hope. You heard in the sermonette today by Mr. Smith talking about waiting and coming to a point in time where finally we'll be able to look back and say, this is what we waited for, and now it's here. But he was talking in concrete, understandable terms. He didn't say, well, we're just going to rest in Jesus. Because if he had, I'd have said, you need to work on that sermonette some. And before those four speaking assignments at the feast in Mauritius come up, you need a little bit of work for you there. Brethren, God gives us something to understand. What does it do for us as we obey His commands to assemble? How does it connect to the fall holy days? Well, we're learning our parts in God's plan ever more clearly and ever more firmly. And it becomes more concrete. It becomes more visible. It becomes more understandable every year. That's why we get so excited about it. I mean, you know, you can only eat so many filet mignons at the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, don't get me wrong. I love a good filet mignon. But that's not the point. About the third night in a row, you're saying, oh, you know, I just the idea of having to eat another filet tonight in a nice, you know, glass of wine and Caesar salad. And, oh, well, I don't want to go too much further on that. It's not the Day of Atonement. It's all fair game. I'm allowed to speak these words now. But we're learning our parts, and it all fits together. That it isn't the physical that's so exciting, because that passes. Think of where it leads us. We read the word hope earlier, and I said if you don't know what God asks of you, you don't know what He expects, how do you even have a hope for the future? Hope has to do with the unseen that isn't here yet, that we're waiting for, as we heard. It has to do with the future. So do the meanings of the fall holidays, at least at this point, that's what their meaning is. You look at Romans chapter 8, for example. Romans 8 and verse 24, for we were saved in this hope. But a hope that is seen isn't hope. Why does one still hope for what he sees? There will be coming a time when it's history. But if we hope for what we don't see, then we eagerly wait for it with perseverance. Like he said, you've got to keep waiting. We've got to wait until what we wait for arrives. And it all fits in the context. This is the context that begins where Paul says in verse 18, I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. But that's it, brethren. We have some concept of what he plans to do. We have some concept because of the beauty and the perfection of God's plan and the meaningfulness in his holy times. Read the rest of the chapter, verses 25 or so, right on to the end. It's just an astonishing hammering home the point of what it will mean to be with God's purpose and in his family. Verse 28, one of the powerful verses. We know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are the called according to his purpose. That's on my father's tombstone, and he believed it. And one day, pictured by the Feast of Trumpets, he and so many others will answer the call. That's what we look forward to. The second thing about hope is when we have a certain hope based on God's promises, it does have an effect in our lives. According to what John wrote in 1 John chapter 3, verses 1, 2, and 3, it should mean that those lives are purified. They are made more like his. 1 John 3, verse 1, "Behold what manner of love the Father has bestowed on us that we should be called children of God. Therefore the world doesn't know us because it didn't know him. Beloved, now we're children of God. It hasn't yet been revealed what we shall be, but we know that when he's revealed, we shall be like him." See, that's measurable. You can even go to Revelation chapters 1, 2, 3 and look at what he looks like from a physical perspective in the visions John had. And it says, we'll be like him, for we shall see him as he is, and everyone who has this hope in him purifies himself just as he is pure. I like to use words and toss them around and try to understand their meaning. If it says everyone who has this hope in him does something, purifies himself just as he is pure, then I like to ask myself a question. Okay, if I'm not purifying myself, if I'm not making progress in becoming more like Jesus Christ, Philippians 2:5, let this mind be in you. If that's not happening, do I really have that hope in him? Is the hope not as clarified as it ought to be? Is it not as sharp in its focus as it ought to be for me? Well, then if so, I better get back to the basics here and put my nose in the book and get on my knees and ask for his help to make it more clear. At least that's the way I think. We look to the future. It has a result. Look at Hebrews chapter 6. Another result of the effect it has. Hebrews chapter 6, verses 17, 18, and 19. "Thus God, determining to show more abundantly to the heirs of promise," that includes us, "the immutability of his counsel." In other words, the unchangeableness of his purpose, the margin has. Isn't that good to know that God's purpose is unchangeable? It's rock solid. You can fully put your hope in it. "Determining to show more abundantly to the heirs of promise the immutability of his counsel, the unchangeableness of his purpose, confirmed it by an oath, that by two immutable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, that we might have strong consolation," that is his oath and his promise, "who have fled for refuge to lay hold of the hope set before us." If you set something before someone, what do you do? My wife's a teacher, substitute teacher. When she sets something before the class, what does she do? She explains it. She shows what the lesson means. And hopefully they get it. Well, brethren, that's what God's done for us. And part of it, a major part of it, is through the meanings of the annual festivals. He has set this hope before us because he spells out his plan in these beautiful times every year. This hope we have as an anchor of the soul. I don't know about you, but those words are very reassuring. We have this hope as an anchor of the soul, sure and steadfast. which enters the presence behind the veil where the forerunners entered for us, Jesus, having become high priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. An anchor of the soul. Aren't you glad you have something you can anchor your life to when you look around us in the world and ask, is there anything you can depend on in this world? We do. We do. And the future, of course, has the holy days written all over it. The script is there and we're learning it. One more point is that this hope is expressed as a full assurance. Full assurance. That describes how completely we can depend on it and how completely it can change our lives. In that way, it's described the same way as faith is in Hebrews 10:22, and the same way as understanding is in Colossians 2 and verse 2. It's here in Hebrews 6, if you back up just a few verses. Hebrews 6, verse 9, "Beloved, we're confident of better things concerning you, things that accompany salvation, even though we speak in this manner. God is not unjust to forget your work and labor of love, which you've shown toward his name, and that you have ministered to the saints, and you do minister. And we desire that each one of you show the same diligence to the full assurance of hope until the end, that you don't become sluggish, but imitate those who through faith and patience inherit the promises." Full assurance. It is completely dependable. It can change our lives completely. And we never have to lose hope. Our lives have to change before we'll be in God's kingdom. It isn't, you know, Jesus, I come as I am to you. That's not the way we work. He says, no, no, Philippians 2:5, you must become like me with my help. Matthew 5:48, as your Father in heaven is perfect, become you perfect. It's a process. We're on the road. He'll help us. Where does hope come from? Well, can't be any doubt about that. It actually says in Romans 15:13 that God is the author. He's the God of hope. I'll just throw a few quick scriptures at you if you want to do a little Bible study further about how hope is described in the New Testament. It's described 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 16 and 17. It's described as good, a good hope. The context is comfort and consolation. It's described in Titus chapter 2 and verse 13 as the blessed hope. Titus 2:13, blessed hope. The connection is the redemption and the purifying zeal for God's people. Peter describes it as a living hope. 1 Peter 1 and verse 3. Context is salvation itself in his first letter. Hebrews 7:19 calls it a better hope. A better hope. And that's the hope for the future we can rely on. Far better than anything in this world or what it has to offer. Full sonship in God's family. The picture in the fall holy days. Please again remember Mr. Franks's admonition about not forgetting the importance of trumpets and atonement. I know we get excited about the feast, and we should. You know, you heard the announcements, no local services, the 15th and the 22nd. When I heard that, I'm thinking, okay, where will I be on the 15th and 22nd? Well, we'll be at the feast site already. I'm sure many of you will be. Along those lines, let me add one more reminder from Mr. Horchak. It was directed to the ministry, and he asked us to pass it on, and I will. It's connected, in a way, to our zeal and our eagerness to get to the Feast of Tabernacles. But as Mr. Horchak said, please remind the brethren. He said, remember that in a year when the holy days fall as they do this year, with atonement on a Wednesday and the feast opening on a Sunday night at sunset, there is another holy day between atonement and the feast. It's a weekly holy day, the Sabbath, that begins at sunset on Friday, October the 14th, and ends at sunset Saturday night, the 15th of October. Mr. Horchak pointed out in his letter to the ministry, many congregations are canceling local services on that date, as we are, due to the proximity to the opening service of the feast. But that doesn't mean that 24-hour period from Friday night sunset, October 14th, to Saturday night sunset, October 15th, is any less holy than any other Sabbath, weekly or annual, that God gives us. Holy time is holy time is holy time. It doesn't somehow become just another day for us to plan our extensive travels to the feast. If there is any way to avoid more than what you would normally consider an appropriate Sabbath day's journey on the Sabbath, then by all means avoid it. It's not a day to say, I'm going to drive 12 hours today to get to the feast. Not appropriate. In fact, virtually all feast sites are making provision for a weekly Sabbath service on site on the Sabbath of October the 15th before the feast starts. If you can't make it to that ahead of time, then work your travel plans. But some local church areas that are relatively close to the feast sites will have Sabbath services that day as well. You can check certainly online to find out which ones. So looking at all these things, Mr. Smith started today by asking about us waiting. So I'll ask a question related to that as we close the day. When will all this be? How will it be accomplished? When will the reality come to pass? You know, there's an interesting thread here. The biblical concept of hope is so closely tied to the calling God gives us, the way of life He expects us to lead, the redemption and the comfort He gives us in that calling, and the greatest hope of all, the future He promises. We read it in Hebrews 6. It is an anchor for the soul. And He commands us to commemorate it every year in the fall holy days. And we get excited about that, as we should. The deep meaning, which He shows us more clearly every year. You and I don't know when the meetings will take place, when they will happen. And we plan every year to look ahead and to keep them. I turned around before services began today, and I said a word to Mrs. Julie Mackey sitting behind me. I said, you know, it still happens. I still turn around, and I look for Dick Hendenlang. He kept the feast last year, his last feast. He is sealed for the resurrection. You and I don't know the timing of it. We do know the certainty of it. That's what God promises in His Word. Every year we rehearse our lines and our places and our cues. The themes in the festivals every year. Do you know your place in God's plan? Do you know where you come in? Do you know your cues? Are you and I learning our parts well? Do we know what the place is God has for us in His astonishing and amazing plan? It's the grandest production, the biggest drama that has ever been created. Its director is God the Father, assisted ably by His Son, Jesus Christ. It's the greatest creation of all time. It is the creation of the family of God. And you and I have the rare privilege to understand a little bit more about it in the next 3 to 4 weeks. Are you ready?